All right, hey everybody. And I'll begin by reading the entire Rumi quote that Ron was trying to quote earlier and couldn't recall the full bit. Unable to perceive the shape of you, I see you all around me. Your presence fills my eyes with your love. It humbles my heart, for you are everywhere. Rumi. Very sweet. I especially love the first line. The line you remembered, Ron, would be my favorite part of that. And hi, Jay, as well as everybody else. Hi, George. Hi, Meg. Hi, Don. Hi, Radio. I'm looking at consciousness in the absolute with Nisargadatta. And the message that I have to begin tonight is January 9th, 1981. But before I do that, Nisargadatta in the last few messages has been saying that without a body, there is no consciousness. And I think that when I was reading those sentences, I may have misunderstood what Nisargadatta was saying. I guess I have to say may have misunderstood because Nisargadatta is not here to confirm the correct understanding. here's what I think I was misunderstanding. I think that I was thinking that he was saying that when the body dies, there is no consciousness anymore. And I got to be honest with you, I wanted to teach what I thought Nisargadatta was saying, but I wasn't 100% comfortable with that. And I think I mentioned this in one of the teachings several weeks ago when I said, you know, I had the experience of being an apple. And of course, an apple is a type of body, I suppose, but I experienced consciousness as an apple. So as a result, I don't think consciousness is limited to the physical human body. Of course, part of that could be how you define consciousness. I think that Bernadette Roberts defines consciousness in a very specific way, and the consciousness that I experienced as an apple would not be the consciousness that she describes, which is the bending of the mind on itself. There is no mind in an apple. So there's definitely no bending of the mind on itself. So when I say I experienced consciousness as an apple, I mean there was awareness and there was knowledge. And the knowledge was very simple. Without any kind of language or words at all, because of course an apple wouldn't have that either. The knowledge was that everything is life awareness. The knowledge was that everything inside of me, which I'm sure was, I mean, apples have cells too, right? I don't know much about biology, but I assume they're made up of cells too. I assume, so when I say everything inside of me, that must have been cells. I knew everything inside of me was life awareness. And I knew everything outside of me was life awareness. And that there was no difference anywhere. And that's what I call the consciousness of the apple. So when Nisargadatta says no body, no consciousness, you know, I wanted to be loyal to what I thought he meant and teach that, but I didn't feel that I agreed. I didn't agree with the feeling that if there's not a human body, there's not consciousness. And that's what I thought he was saying. But last week, just before I was falling asleep one night, the way I remember it, a different interpretation of those sentences came in. And that different interpretation felt very right. So I wanted to come back and share that with you. The interpretation was more when there's no consciousness, there's no body. You know, for example, if you imagine being deep enough in meditation that you go into what is called samadhi, or what Bernadette Roberts would have called ecstasy, from that place, there is no body. When the consciousness goes, the body goes. In fact, when the consciousness goes, the world goes. And because that interpretation came in when I wasn't even thinking about this teaching, you know, I wasn't trying to figure it out or anything. I was just going to sleep. I kind of trust that. I trust that that's really what that means. When there's no body, there's no consciousness, meaning that when there's no consciousness, there's no body, right? That the two go together in that way. You're conscious of the world because of consciousness. And when you transcend consciousness, there is no world, right? So I just wanted to come back and share that with you before I got started on the new message. And I think it's the January 9th message. Yeah, I think it is the January 9th message. So let's look at the January 9th message, which is on page 38. And the questioner says, what are thoughts? And Nisargadatta must have been at the Freedom from the Ego retreat last week. Because he says, they are the result of previous conditioning which the mind has had. We didn't really use the word conditioning last week. We were using the word programming because that's the word that showed up in the videos that we started with. But it's the same thing, right? So this is exactly what we talked about all last week. They are the result of the previous conditioning or the previous programming which the mind has had. The questioner says, are the thoughts of the Yanani and the ignorant one different from one another? And this is a question that probably many people have. You know, when you're enlightened, do your thoughts change? We'll see what Nisargadatta says. The difference is that the Yanani has divorced himself from the body-mind. The body-mind thoughts will come and go, but the Yanani is not concerned. I may have read this last week. It's sounding familiar. But the Yanani is not concerned, whereas the ignorant one gets involved in those thoughts, and the ignorant one considers himself as a name and a form. And certainly I do not claim to be enlightened. But I can tell you about my experience because there have been some important shifts, and as a result, my experience is different. Once upon a time, my mind was filled with judgment thoughts, unworthiness thoughts, grievances, attack, defense, fear, worry. And my mind is not filled with those things anymore. And that's the honest truth. What I notice about my mind is if I'm not focused on something, whether that's focused on a spiritual practice or focused on work or focused on a TV show or focused on somebody talking to me, when I'm focused on someone or something, my mind is empty and I'm just focused. But when I am not focused, my mind still likes to chatter. But what I find that's interesting about the chatter is it is extremely benign. And by benign, I mean it's not filled with judgments. It's not filled with grievances. It's not filled with attack. It's not filled with fear and worry. It's not filled with defense. It's just, talking. It could be repeating a conversation. It likes to repeat stuff, repeating a conversation that was had earlier. It could be narrating what I'm doing. It's completely meaningless chatter, but it likes to keep talking. And I used to feel like that shouldn't be, like something must be wrong because the mind is chattering. I've since decided that as long as I give that chatter no meaning whatsoever, it's okay. So again, Nisargadatta is saying that the Yanani has divorced himself from the body-mind, and the body-mind's thoughts will come and go, but the Yanani is not concerned. And I would say that's a decision that I have made to place myself there, to not be concerned about the chattering of the mind. But I also want to point out that the thoughts are not at all the same quality as before. As I mentioned, my mind is not filled with judgment. It's not filled with grievance, attack, defense, blame, unworthiness. I rarely see those types of thoughts. I say rarely because I think it's important to say they do sometimes come up. And when they come up, they're noticed for what they are and immediately let go. The questioner says, should I keep in mind constantly that I am consciousness only? Nisargadatta says, you are consciousness, and consciousness is you, and that's it. It is not necessary to always keep your attention on that fact. When you know that this is your finger, is it necessary to constantly repeat, this is my finger. This is my finger. What is there to be done? So again, I'm going to share from my experience. I think that I did find it important for a time to focus on myself as consciousness and to focus on everything as consciousness. And now, some of you know, I have upped the ante. I am contemplating myself as, I call it stillness life, but today in the Tao it was called non-being. And I contemplate non-being or stillness life as the only reality. And I suppose to me the difference between that and this is my finger, this is my finger, is that, you know, this is my finger, or I've heard Muji say, you know, you don't have to contemplate your name. You know your name is Regina. If somebody yells Regina, your head turns because you know that. You don't have to walk around contemplating, I am Regina, I am Regina. And I suppose the difference between not having to contemplate my finger or not having to contemplate my name as Regina is that those things are already fully ingrained into the brain and or the subconscious. You know, Muji's right. If you yell Regina, my head turns. I don't have to stop and think, ooh, is that person calling me? Right? That's already programmed, Regina, already programmed my finger. Right? But as long as the programming goes to Regina, my finger, which really means body, and as long as the programming goes to thought as me, right? I found it useful to counteract that by contemplating I'm consciousness. I'm the openness that the thought is arising in. And like I said, now I've upped the ante and I'm contemplating non-being, the absolute. And I think, you know, even though Nisargadatta is telling this particular person that they don't need to contemplate consciousness, I think we've seen Nisargadatta teach that many, many times that you do. So I'm going to say he's talking to a particular individual here and that he would also say it's very, very important. In fact, I remember quotes by Nisargadatta saying, how do you find a thing, I think is the correct word. How do you find a thing? If there's something you want to find, you keep your mind on it. You keep thinking of it until you find it or something similar to that. That's the instruction to contemplate consciousness. I would say that when consciousness is as natural to you as your identity, as your name is now, you don't need to contemplate it anymore at that point, right? The questioner says, when an action must be done or a choice made, how should one make the choice? Nisargadatta says, just understand that it is not your personal action or choice. Do not get involved as the doer. The way that I teach that, I would probably never tell anyone, don't get involved as the doer. Although I understand what Nisargadatta is saying, but I think I wouldn't say that because that language never really connected with me. So I'm not going to share a language that doesn't connect with me, right? That doesn't make any sense. But what I tell people is just wait until you know. You don't need to think about it. When it's time for you to know what you're going to say or what you're going to do, you will know. That knowledge will arise, right? You don't have to think about it. So let's say I have to make a decision in 3 weeks, early January, about where I think we should go for Jasmine spring break this year. You know, let's say we're considering two or three places, and I have to make a decision. I don't have to spend the next 2 or 3 weeks thinking about that. I don't have to spend, if I want to look up hotels and stuff, you know, look up what there is to do in the different places, I can, but I don't have to do that as a part of making the decision. That would just be mere entertainment. When it's time for me to know where we're going to go, I will just have an intuitive feeling. I will just know one place will feel right and the other places won't. So how do you make a choice? I say wait until you know. Just let the choice be made in you, right? And then the choice is made. You don't really have to make it. And that's probably the same as saying don't get involved as the doer. It's just different language. Then Nisargadatta says, why do you get involved in all these concepts? And that's interesting that he would say that, because I was kind of having the same thought, because it's a very short message. And I don't know that it's one questioner, but typically it is one questioner. This questioner, in just a few minutes with Nisargadatta, has asked, are the thoughts of the Yanani and the ignorant man different? Should I keep in mind constantly that I am consciousness? When an action must be done or a choice made, how should I make the choice? Now, some people might say this is very efficient use of an enlightened person's time. You know, here you are, you're in front of a very enlightened person. You have three burning questions, and good for you. You know, you just got to the chase. You asked those three burning questions. You got your answers. That was great use of that time. But what occurred to me, and it seems to be occurring in Nisargadatta too, is that the person is thinking too much about the spiritual path. Right? Thinking too much. You know, does a Yanani and ignorant man have the same or different thoughts? Should I practice being consciousness? You know, how do I make decisions? It's like the person is thinking all the time about what's right to do, what's wrong to do on the spiritual path. And Nisargadatta says, why do you get involved in all these concepts? First, find out what you consider yourself to be. Are you an entity? Get that problem solved instead of getting involved in all kinds of concepts. What are you? You cannot understand with your intellect. It is beyond the grasp of the intellect. So he is asking the person not to think so much. I think thinking a lot about spirituality is something we probably all do. You know, and there isn't a single question here that this particular questioner has asked that I haven't at one time wanted to ask. Probably you guys have wanted to ask the same questions, right? But at some point, the questions die in us, literally. We don't have any more questions, even if there was a great enlightened master in front of us. We wouldn't have a question. We might enjoy being in the presence, and we might enjoy watching the enlightened person interact with other people, but there won't be a question anymore. And that comes about when we learn to trust and follow our own inner intuition in every moment. And that's a non-thinking activity, right? You just feel for what feels right, and you do that. Like this morning, when I was in contemplation, it's funny because I give you guys typically 4 quotes a day. When I contemplate, I just contemplate until I feel done. And sometimes I'll go back and count. It was 6 quotes or it was 8 quotes. You know, I don't follow the same rules I feed you guys, which is kind of funny. But today, you know, I'm contemplating and I'm going quote after quote after quote. And then all of a sudden there was the feeling just to stop. So I stopped. And then the feeling was just to sit, be still, and stare out the window. So I sat and was still and stared out the window. And then the feeling was to go back to contemplation. And I went back to contemplation. And what I found myself writing was that it was time for me now to abandon my teachers. You know, that my teachers, you know, they've given some great advice and I've really appreciated it, but that I can't listen to anyone anymore except for myself. Yeah, so, you know, if you're coming to the point, especially the point where you're abandoning your teachers, how could you possibly have any questions? You're way beyond the intellect at that point, right? You've just become so connected to your own inner guidance. It doesn't even matter if the one who was your teacher before would say that you're doing it right or you're doing it wrong. It no longer even matters what that one would say. Now you are so connected to your own intuition and you trust it so much that you're willing to walk entirely alone and follow this path. But until that arises, there are questions, because until you have that firm connection to your own inner intuition, you do think that you could do this right or that you could do this wrong. And you do think that there are people out there who know more than you, teachers specifically. And you do want to know what they have to say. I mean, it's just a part of the phase, right? You do want to know what they have to say. You want them to give you that guidance because you have not yet got that firm connection with your own inner intuition. And so that's okay too, for as long as that phase lasts. But you know, I'm reminded of something that supposedly Buddha said, which when I was earlier on the spiritual path, I didn't understand at all. You know how you cannot understand something and then after you mature to a certain point, it makes perfect sense. You know, Buddha said that if you see the Buddha on the highway, kill him. Whoa, what the heck does that mean? You know, that's what I used to think. What the heck does that mean? You know, why would you kill the Buddha? Well, because you can't actually get the guidance that's completely perfect for you from anyone but you. You can't look outside of you, not even to the greatest teacher in your midst, for your guidance. In the end, it can only come from you. Ron says, I think he's talking to me. Are you talking to me when you say this, Ron? He says, You've saved several years of trial and error in understanding how to retrain the mind. And I know you're talking about last week's retreat, right? Yeah, of course. We can definitely learn useful things from our teachers. But one of the things I said multiple times last week, and I know everyone heard it, is I said, here's how I did it. You have to find your own way. This is what works for me. Something else may work for you. I mean, the basic idea was the same. But, you know, there were little specific things that I would say to myself in order to help me make a particular choice or whatever. And I kept telling everyone, you have to find your own way, whatever. And I would say, whatever works for you, it doesn't matter what it is. And in fact, Ron shared something that worked with him, something about aliens. That, you know, and that was perfect. Do you want to share what that was?
Sure. There are times that what has helped me understand my purpose, or kind of the condition that I found myself in, is that I'm really from a different planet, just or on special assignment undercover, and I have nothing really to do with that population. I'm just trying to fit in. I'm just trying to, you know, see what's really going on and kind of understand how it is they go about doing things, and even mimicking them, just to kind of see what it's like to do it. Because it's not me; it has nothing to do with me at all. I'm totally different. So it doesn't, you know, what the actual actions that I'm taking or doing is just kind of mimicking what other people's human behavior is, and nothing more than that.
Yeah, good. Yeah. So I was telling people they could use imagination as long as the imagination helped them to be detached, help them to release control, help them to choose the right mind over the wrong mind, right? Whatever works. I used to use imagination a lot, especially in Rest, Accept, and Trust. I would imagine, you know, the feelings were like a gas that started down in the gut and would rise up and evaporate out the head. And that imagination allowed me to stay with some really awful feelings until those feelings were healed. So I'm done. I guess the moral of the story here is it can be beneficial to contemplate I am consciousness. And it's okay to ask teachers questions, but at some point expect to abandon your teachers. And any good teacher wants you to get to the point where you no longer need her. And yet she's at your service for as long as she's useful. All right, releasing the mic.